Macmillan Audio presents The Last One at the Wedding by Jason Rukulek. Read by John Perhala. Part 1. The Invitation. 1. My phone lit up with the words unknown caller, which usually meant some kind of scam, but I guess I felt like talking because I answered anyway. Hello?
Dad?
I shot up so fast my knees banged against the kitchen table, sloshing coffee all over my bacon and eggs. Maggie? Is that you? She answered, but I couldn't make out the words. Her voice was faint. The line hissed and crackled, like I was going to lose her at any moment. Hang on, hon. I can barely hear you. The kitchen is the worst room in my house for taking calls. You never get more than a bar or two of signal strength. I carried the phone into my living room and tripped over some lumber I'd been trimming and sanding and staining. Just a little carpentry project to kill the time at night. It would all turn into a coffee table, eventually, but I could never motivate myself to finish the job, so there were screws and sawdust all over my rug. I hopscotched through the mess and rushed down the hall to Maggie's childhood bedroom. She had a tiny window overlooking our backyard and the old Lackawanna rail lines, and when I leaned against the glass, the signal popped up to 3 bars. Maggie, is this better?
Hello?
She still sounded a million miles away, like she was calling from overseas, or from a cabin deep in a remote wilderness, or from the trunk of an abandoned car buried at the bottom of an underground garage.
Dad, can you hear me?
Are you okay?
Dad, hello? Can you hear me?
I mashed the phone to my ear and shouted, "Yes, yes," I could hear her. Where are you? Do you need help? And the line went dead. Call failed. Our first conversation in 3 years, and it hadn't lasted even a minute. 2. But now I had her number. Now I finally had a way to reach her. I pressed call back and got a busy signal. I tried again, 2, 3, 4 times, busy, 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 because she was calling me. I was so excited. My hands were shaking. I forced myself to stop dialing and waited for the phone to ring. I sat at the foot of the bed and glanced impatiently around my daughter's bedroom. All her old stuff was still here. I never had house guests, never had any reason to get rid of it. All her posters from high school were still taped up. One Direction, and the Jonas Brothers, and a goofy grinning sloth hanging from a tree. There was a big shelf of sports trophies and a big wicker basket filled with stuffed animals. Most days I kept the door closed and tried to ignore the room's existence. But every so often, more than I care to admit, I'd come inside and sit on her giant beanbag chair. And let myself remember when we were all still here and still acting like a family. I'd remember how Colleen and I used to squeeze into the little twin bed, and Maggie would plop between us, and we'd laugh ourselves silly reading Goodnight Gorilla. My phone buzzed again. The same unknown caller.
Dad, is this better?
Now her voice was clear. Now she could have been sitting right beside me, changed into her Lion King pajamas and ready for bed. Maggie, are you okay?
I'm fine, Dad. Everything's fine.
Where are you?
I'm home. I mean, my apartment, in Boston. And everything is fine.
I waited for her to continue, but she didn't say anything. Maybe she didn't know where to start. And neither did I, really. How many times had I imagined this moment? How many times had I rehearsed this conversation while standing in the shower? Now it was finally happening, and all I could think to blurt out was, "Did you get my cards?" Because, God, I sent this kid so many cards. Birthday cards, Halloween cards, just because cards, always with $10 or $20 of pocket money and a little note.
"I got them," she said. "I've been meaning to call for a while now, actually."
"I'm so sorry, Maggie. This whole situation..."
"I don't want to talk about it."
"Okay. All right." I felt like one of those hostage negotiators on Rescue 911. My number one objective was keeping Maggie on the phone, keeping her talking. So I pivoted to a safer topic. "Are you still at capacity?"
"Yeah, I just had my 3-year anniversary."
Maggie was so damn proud of that job. She was hired by capacity right around the time our trouble started, and long before anyone had ever heard of the place. Back then, it was just one of 1,000 Cambridge startups promising to change the world with a new top-secret technology. Now they have 800 employees spread across 3 continents, and they'd just run a Super Bowl commercial with George Clooney and Matt Damon. I read everything I could find about the company, always searching for a glimpse of my daughter's name, or at least some insights into her life and career. "Those new Chevys look amazing," I told her. "As soon as the prices come down..." She cut me off mid-sentence.
"Dad, I've got some news. I'm getting married."
She didn't pause to let the information sink in. She just started spilling the details like she couldn't hold them back anymore. Her fiancé's name was Aiden, he was 26 years old, his family was hosting the reception at their home in New Hampshire, and all the while, I was stuck on the first bombshell. She was getting married?
"And in spite of everything that's happened," Maggie continued, "I'd really like you to be there."
3. My name is Frank Zatowski, and I am 52 years old. I've spent most of my adult life driving a package car for the United Parcel Service. You know, those big brown trucks rumbling around your neighborhood full of goodies from the internet. UPS calls them package cars, even though they're technically large step vans. I started driving young, straight out of the Army. And I was recently inducted into the Circle of Honor, an elite group of UPS drivers who've worked 25 years without an accident. I make a decent living, and I've always liked the work, even though it keeps getting harder and harder. When I started, back in the late 90s, most of the parcels were still boxes. The heaviest thing you'd lift might be a gateway computer. These days, forget it. Any given shift, we're hauling futons, file cabinets, artificial Christmas trees, flat screens, even ping pong tables. And car tires, holy mother of God, those are the worst. Did you know you can buy car tires online? They ship in packs of 4, strapped together and bundled in cardboard, so we can't even roll the damn things. Still, if I pulled enough overtime, I could usually clear $100,000. My Jeep was all paid off, my mortgage was close, and I didn't owe a penny to Visa or MasterCard. I was 3 years away from early retirement, with a decent pension and comprehensive health care. Not bad for a guy who never went to college, right? Up until my wife passed and all my troubles with Maggie started, I used to say I was blessed. I used to feel like the luckiest bastard on earth. So now listen to what happened.
"The wedding's in 3 months," Maggie told me. "July 23rd. I know I'm calling super last minute, but..."
"I'll be there," I said, and my voice cracked because I was starting to cry. "Of course I'll be there."
"Okay, good. Because we're mailing the invites tomorrow, and I wanted to call first."
And then the conversation sputtered out, like she was expecting me to say something, but I was too choked up to answer. I made a fist and thumped my breastbone, 3 hard whacks to keep myself from blubbering. Come on, Frankie, keep it together. Don't be such a baby.
Dad, are you still there?
Tell me about Aiden, I suggested, my future son-in-law. Where did you meet him?
At a costume party, back on Halloween. I went as Pam, from the office, and Aiden came as Jim. So as soon as he showed up, everyone wanted us to stand together. We started doing scenes from the show, and his impression was totally spot on.
I had trouble focusing on her story, because I was too busy doing the math. You met last Halloween? 6 months ago?
But it feels like I've known him forever. Sometimes we're talking and I swear he can read my mind, like we have a telepathic connection. Did you and Mom ever feel that way?
Sure, I guess, when we first met. But then we got older and wiser and realized these were just signs of youthful infatuation. I didn't bother pointing this out. I loved hearing the happiness in Maggie's voice, the sweet music of hope and optimism. What's Aiden do for a living?
He's a painter.
In the union?
No, not a house painter. He makes art.
I was determined to sound supportive, but you have to admit, this was a curveball. He makes art for a living?
Well, he has a couple things in galleries, but right now he's building up his name, growing his reputation. That's how it works. Plus, he teaches a class at Mass Art.
What does he get for that?
I'm sorry?
How much does he make?
I'm not going to tell you.
I couldn't understand why not, but I heard her taking a deep breath and getting annoyed, so I decided not to push it. Maybe Maggie was right. Maybe her future artist husband's salary was none of my business. Besides, I still had plenty of other questions. First marriage?
Yes.
Any kids?
0 kids and 0 debt. Don't worry.
What about his mother?
I love her. She's got some health issues right now. Lots of migraines, but she started a new medicine, and it's really helping.
And his dad?
Fantastic. Amazing.
What's he do? Maggie hesitated.
That part's a little complicated.
How is it complicated?
It's not complicated. It's just more of a conversation than I want to have right now.
What the hell was that supposed to mean? It's a straightforward question, Maggie. How does he make a living?
The headline is, I'm getting married, and I want you to come to the wedding, July 23rd in New Hampshire.
But you can't tell me what his father does?
I could tell you, but you'll have more questions, and I need to go. I have a dress fitting at 10, and the seamstress is a total psycho. If I'm a single minute late, she'll make me reschedule the whole appointment.
Clearly, she just wanted to get off the phone, but I couldn't resist making one more push. Is Aiden's father in jail?
No, it's nothing bad.
Is he famous? Is he an actor?
He's not an actor.
But he's famous?
I told you, I don't want to get into it.
Just give me his name, Maggie. I'll Google him.
The line seemed to go dead for a moment, like the call had been dropped, or perhaps she'd muted the phone to confer with someone. And then she was back.
I think we should talk about it over dinner. Me and you and Aiden. Could you maybe drive up to Boston?
And of course I could drive up to Boston. I could drive all the way to the North Pole if that was what Maggie wanted. She suggested Saturday night at 7 o'clock, and she gave me the name of an Irish pub on Fleet Street, near the old State House. Then she insisted she had to end the conversation and get to her dress fitting.
I'll see you this weekend. I'm really looking forward to it.
I said, me too.
But I couldn't end the call without one more attempt at an apology.
And listen, Maggie, I am so sorry for everything.
okay? I've felt so awful these past few years. I know I screwed up. I should have handled things better. And I wish... And then I was interrupted by a soft click. She'd already hung up.
4.
My wife died from a brain aneurysm, one of these ticking time bomb things. Colleen used to work at Michael's, the arts and crafts store. One minute she's helping a school teacher look for glitter glue. Next thing you know, she's down on the floor, lights out. Died in the ambulance on the way to Holy Redeemer. 36 years old. A tragedy on multiple levels, when you consider all the awful stuff I'm going to tell you about. Because my wife could spot a bullshitter from a mile away. She would have seen this trouble coming, long before I did. Maggie was only 10 years old when her mother passed, right on the cusp of puberty and womanhood, and at pretty much the worst age to lose a parent. I remember wishing that I had gotten the aneurysm instead of Colleen, because my wife could have raised Maggie just fine, and my Teamster's pension would have provided for them. Instead, I had to make do with help from my sister, Tammy. She lived 6 miles away and gave me a ton of help. She was always driving Maggie to doctor's appointments and dentist visits and contact lens fittings and OBGYN screenings and dermatology checkups and a million other things, so I could pay the bills and keep food on our table. It was a stressful time of life, and I am first to admit that I made a shit ton of mistakes. You know you've messed up pretty bad when your only daughter stops speaking to you, when she gives you the silent treatment for 3 whole years. But I'll talk about that whole situation later. Before I tell you the story of Maggie's previous so-called boyfriend, I want to tell you about her new fiancé and why I was instantly suspicious. The day after her big surprise announcement, Maggie called me back with a change of plans. "We think you should come to our apartment instead. We'll just eat here." She hadn't mentioned that she and Aiden were already living together, but I wasn't too surprised. Boston rents were brutally expensive, and Aiden probably saved a fortune by gaining a roommate. Plus, Maggie always hated her old apartment anyway. It was a tiny, damp studio in the basement of a Victorian brownstone, and the place was overrun with silverfish, long, hairy insects that looked like giant eyebrows. They fell into Maggie's bathtub every time she took a shower, and she'd have to tap dance around their bloated, drowning bodies. My daughter claimed to spend all her weekends in the capacity offices just to steer clear of the dank, damp apartment. I'm sure she was thrilled to break her lease and move to Aiden's place. But I pushed to meet at a restaurant anyway. "This is a special occasion. I don't want you to cook."
"I'm not cooking."
"Aiden's cooking?"
"We worked it out, Dad. You just need to show up."
I thought I understood what was happening. I figured that with a big wedding on the horizon, the kids were looking at their checkbooks and cutting expenses. I'd already Googled how much do they pay art teachers. And let me tell you something, it is not good. The median salary was 40 grand, and that won't go far in a city like Boston. 40 grand won't get you more than a couple of cans of baked beans. I assured Maggie that I wanted to pay for the entire meal at the restaurant of their choice. Chinese, Italian, anything you want. Let's splurge. But she insisted I come to their apartment.
"It's right off Route 93, by the Zakim Bridge."
"You live next to a bridge?"
"Not literally next to it, but you can see it from our window."
"And it's safe there? My Jeep will be okay?"
"It'll be fine, Dad. Aiden's lived here 3 years, and he's never had any problems."
She seemed to think my questions were silly. But let's be honest, these days you can't turn on the radio without hearing about another homicide or carjacking or random bursts of gunfire. And right off Route 93 didn't sound like the best of neighborhoods, That highway was choked with traffic all day long, and no one with any money would choose to live near it. Still, I kept these concerns to myself and asked Maggie to text me the address. I was keeping an open mind. I was ready to meet my daughter anywhere. 5. Apart from a 4-year stint in the United States Army, I've lived my whole life in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania, a small borough of 6,000 people in the Pocono Mountains. We're popular with tourists because we've got skiing, swimming, horseback riding, and miles of hiking trails, plus a nice downtown with restaurants and shops. In the winter, we dress it all up with twinkle lights, and it looks like a Lifetime Christmas movie. March brings the annual St. Paddy's Day parade with fire trucks and bagpipes and the high school marching band. And every July, we have Stroud Fest, which is a giant outdoor music festival with live bands and dancing in the streets. I'm not trying to suggest we're any kind of world-class travel destination. I know Wolfgang Puck won't be opening a restaurant here anytime soon. But Stroudsburg is clean and affordable, and the schools are pretty good. You keep hearing about all these other small towns going broke, but somehow we're still getting by. Boston was a long drive from home, and I left early, anxious to get on the road. Halfway through Connecticut, I started seeing billboards for the new Chrysler Reactor and the Miracle Battery, which is the product that put capacity on the map. It's got the best range of any EV sold in the United States, well over 800 miles on a single charge, even with the music loud and the AC blasting. Every billboard had the same slogan, "The future of driving is clean," and I felt a little shiver of pride whenever I passed one, because Maggie worked in the marketing department, and I liked to believe that she'd helped with the signs, or at least knew the people who did. All these giant, expensive advertisements seen by millions of drivers every day, and my daughter had played a part in them. I wished her mother was alive to see it. A little after 2 o'clock, I stopped in Worcester, about an hour west of Boston, to look around for a cheap hotel. There was a Super 8 right off the highway, advertising vacancies for $69, and the manager was happy to grant me an early check-in, so I didn't bother to shop around. The room was on the shabby side, with water stains on the ceiling and cigarette burns on the furniture. But the mattress was firm, and the bathroom was clean, so I felt like I got a good deal. On my way into the city, I stopped at a Sam's Club to pick up some flowers. They always have these nice little bouquets right by the registers. And then once I got in the store, I had to buy Pepperidge Farm Milano cookies, because they were always Maggie's favorite. And 2 small fire extinguishers, because they were on sale for $10, and you can always use some extras. Were all these gifts a little excessive? Maybe. But I still remembered what it was like to be young and starting out, and I thought Maggie and Aiden would appreciate the help. By 6 o'clock, I'd made it to the Charles River and found myself snarled in Boston gridlock. It was a long, painful crawl over the Zakim Bridge, but traffic got better on the other side. I took the first exit and then followed the river for a mile or so until the road dead-ended at an enormous tower of steel and glass, Beacon Plaza. The GPS said I'd arrived at my destination, but I knew right away there'd been a mistake. It looked like the skyscraper in Die Hard. My headlights pointed at a sign listing all the major tenants: Accenture, Liberty Mutual, Santander Bank, and a bunch of names that sounded like law firms. It was Saturday night, so most of the floors were dark, but I saw a woman through the windows of the lobby, so I left my Jeep in a loading zone and went inside to ask for directions. I felt like I was entering a cathedral, a vast cavernous space built of glass and polished stone. On a normal day, I imagined that thousands of commuters passed through this lobby on their way to work. But now it was just me and a lone young woman in the center of the room, standing at a high desk that resembled an altar.
"Mr. Zatowski?" she asked.
I couldn't believe it. How do you know my name?
Margaret told us you were coming. I just need a quick peek at a photo ID, sir. A driver's license will be fine.
She was blonde and petite and very pretty, dressed in a trim blue suit. I reached for my wallet, a worn leather billfold frayed at the seams, on the verge of falling apart. This is an apartment building?
It's mixed use, mostly commercial, but the top floors where Aiden and Margaret live, they're all residential.
I offered my Pennsylvania driver's license, and Olivia, up close I could see her name tag, handled it with tremendous reverence, like I'd just shared an original parchment copy of the Declaration of Independence.
Thank you, Mr. Zatowski. Elevator D is to your right, and that'll take you upstairs.
My car is in the loading zone, I explained. Is there... A young man materialized on my left, as if conjured out of thin air.
I'll take care of your vehicle, Mr. Zatowski. There's a garage beneath the building.
I didn't know what was more incredible, that everyone in the lobby already knew my name or that they were all pronouncing it flawlessly. If you've got any Polish blood, you know the S is silent and it's pronounced Zatowski. But your average person tries to pronounce the S anyway. They call me Mr. Sizatuski, or worse. You would not believe all the different ways people butcher it. He held out his hand, requesting the keys, but I still had all my gifts waiting in the Jeep, so I followed him outside to retrieve them. The young man gave me a paper tag with his phone number, and he instructed me to call it when I was ready to leave so he could have the vehicle waiting for me. I reached into my wallet for a dollar and tried to give it to him, but he backed away like my money was radioactive.
It's my pleasure, sir. Enjoy your evening.
I returned to the lobby and Olivia welcomed me back with another heart-melting smile. I didn't know what this woman was doing stuck behind a reception desk on a Saturday night. She could have been cheerleading for the NFL or modeling for Victoria's Secret.
Enjoy your evening, sir.
Thank you. I stepped aboard Elevator D, a narrow black box with sleek metal walls. It was my first time in an elevator, without buttons. There was no control panel, so I couldn't discern how to make it go. Then the doors slid closed and the elevator started going anyway, seemingly of its own free will. Above the doors, a small screen flickered to life and tallied the numbers of the passing floors. 2, 3, 5, 10, 20, 30, PH1, PH2, PH3. Then the elevator slowed to a stop and the door parted. And there was Maggie, with the setting sun at her back, dressed in a black turtleneck and black pants, holding a long-stemmed glass of white wine and standing on top of the world.
Dad!
Was this a mirage? I'd expected to arrive in a hallway of numbered doors and potted plants. Instead, I had teleported right into someone's living room, bright and lavishly furnished, with giant glass walls overlooking the city skyline. It felt dizzying and disorienting, and also a tiny bit fake, like I'd arrived on the set of a TV show. Where's the apartment? She laughed.
This is the apartment.
You live here?
Since February. After we got engaged, Aiden invited me to move in.
The elevator door started to close and she blocked it with her hand.
Come on, Dad. You need to step off.
I took a careful step forward, disoriented, not completely sure the floor would support me. I almost didn't recognize my daughter. As a little girl, Maggie was what people used to call a tomboy. She favored overalls, sports jerseys, and flannel shirts from my closet, knotted at the waist so they didn't flap around. But then, in high school, she veered hard in the opposite direction, pivoting to swishy skirts and floral sundresses and crazy thrift store discoveries. Now she'd adopted another new look, and this one was pure Cambridge Ivy League, smart and chic, urban and sophisticated. She'd grown out her hair. It fell halfway down her back, fuller, with more layers, like she'd invested real money in it. And there was a light in her eyes that I hadn't seen since childhood. She looked like a Disney princess, ready to burst into song. Or, to put it more simply, my daughter looked head over heels in love. "Maggie, you look amazing." She waved off the compliment.
"Aw, come on."
"I'm serious. What did you do to yourself?"
"It's just the lighting in the apartment. This building makes everyone look like a supermodel. Let me give you a hug."
She put her arms around my waist and pressed her face to my chest, and I was so happy I thought I might start to cry. Because this kid used to hug me every day. When she was 6 years old, we used to play this game called Hug Monster, where she'd crawl around on the rug, snarling and growling and biting my ankles, and the only thing that would turn her back into a little girl was a monster hug that swooped her off the floor, arms and legs flailing. I probably hadn't thought about the game in 10 years, but the memory came bubbling up out of nowhere.
"I'm glad you're here," she said, speaking softly into my shoulder. "Thank you for coming."
And I could feel myself getting choked up again. I worried that if I said anything, my voice would break and I'd start blubbering like a big baby. So I just broke away and gave her my bag of gifts. She seemed confused by the fire extinguishers, but clearly loved the flowers.
"They're beautiful," she said. "Let's get them in water."
I'd never entered an apartment through an elevator, so I needed a minute to orient myself and get my bearings. The living room was just one part of a sprawling open floor plan that wrapped the corner of the tower. The exterior walls were all glass and offered a panoramic view of the city skyline. And the interior walls were covered with faces, men and women of all different ages, all photographed in black and white and staring at the viewer. None of these people would ever be mistaken for supermodels, because their faces had too many flaws. Wrinkles and blotches and drooping eyelids, crooked teeth and thinning hair and pointy chins. In other words, they looked like regular, everyday people. The kind you'd see shopping for groceries or riding the bus after work.
"These are Aiden's," Maggie said proudly.
I looked closer and realized that each photograph was actually a painting, expertly rendered in black and white and shades of silver and gray.
"He's sold a couple, but these are his favorites, so we're hanging on to them. What do you think?"
I thought they were a little creepy, if I'm being honest. All these faces staring out with their cold expressions, looking like they'd been photographed against their will. But then again, if a couple of creepy faces paid the rent for a luxury penthouse apartment, I bet I could learn to live with them. "They're incredible, Maggie. He's very talented." She led me around a corner, through a formal dining area and into a very modern chef's kitchen with two sinks, marble countertops, stainless steel appliances, and lots of tiny computer screens. A short, dark-haired woman stood over the range, stirring a saucepan, but she interrupted her work to welcome me.
"Hello, Mr. Zatowski. I'm Lucia."
"Please, call me Frank. It's great to meet you."
"Lucia's an amazing cook," Maggie said. "I've learned so much from watching her."
Lucia blushed easily. She was still fairly young, and I couldn't figure out how she was related to the family. "Are you Aiden's sister?" She blushed even more, like I'd paid her a compliment.
"Oh, no. I just have the pleasure of cooking for you all tonight.
Maggie explained that Lucia trained at Cariño, one of the few restaurants in Boston to receive a prestigious Michelin star, and now she'd launched a new career as a private chef, preparing meals for guests in the privacy of their homes. And only then did I understand that Aiden had hired this woman to make our dinner.
May I bring you something to drink? We have beer, wine, cocktails, sparkling water.
Whatever's easiest, I told her. Lucia smiled patiently, not quite sure how to proceed, and I realized I was making her job harder.
How about a beer?
Maggie suggested. Perfect, I said. Lucia encouraged us to make ourselves comfortable. She said she would care for the flowers and bring the beer in a minute. Maggie steered me back to the living room and suggested we wait for Aiden outside, on the patio.
He's stuck in traffic, but he'll be home soon.
One of the big windows facing the skyline was actually a door, and with the slightest touch from Maggie's hand, it slid sideways, creating an opening that we stepped through. Like the apartment itself, the patio wrapped around the corner of the building, and it was outfitted with all kinds of lounges, sofas, tables, and fire pits. But, of course, my eyes went right to the view. I'd never seen the city from such spectacular heights. It was a whole new way of looking at Boston. A god's-eye view of Fenway Park, Faneuil Hall, the three-masted ships docked in the harbor. I could see everything laid out before me like a miniature model. Jesus, Maggie, I said. You didn't tell me Aiden was... I stopped short of using the word rich. I didn't want to jump to conclusions. What kind of rent are you paying?
Aiden thinks rent is a waste of money. He bought the unit as an investment property.
How does a 26-year-old art teacher get an investment property?
Well, see, this is why I wanted to meet in person. Aiden's last name is Gardner. His father's Errol Gardner. Do you know who that is?
I'd spent the last 3 years reading everything I could find about capacity. So of course I knew all about Errol Gardner. He was the man behind the Miracle Battery, the company's CEO and chief miracle worker. In the past year alone, he'd been profiled in the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post, and he'd even visited the White House as a guest of President Biden. Maybe he didn't have the name recognition of a Jeff Bezos or an Elon Musk, but to anyone watching the American auto industry, Errol Gardner was a big deal. You're marrying Errol Gardner's son?
You're going to love him. He's really down to earth.
Errol or his son? She laughed.
Both. They're both terrific.
I gripped the handrail to steady myself. Up until this moment, I'd thought I had a clear understanding of Maggie's future. I imagined she would face the traditional climb up the corporate ladder while juggling daycare, childcare, homework, carpools, dance lessons, sports practice, and endless bills, bills, bills. I figured I'd help Maggie and Aiden as much as I could. I'd mail them an extra $100 now and then, just to pitch in. But now here I was, 40 stories above the Charles River, seeing her future from a brand new perspective. I felt like I was standing on Mars, 100 million miles from home.
This is incredible, Maggie.
Why didn't you tell me sooner? She gestured at the skyline, at its hundreds of high-rises and thousands of people and all the tiny blinking lights.
It's hard to describe this over the phone. You need to see it firsthand.
I thought back to her previous apartment, the dank, clammy basement studio with a bathtub full of silverfish. It's a nice change from that dump on Talmadge Street. I only meant it as a joke, but something about the remark made her uncomfortable.
It wasn't a dump, just a little small.
You hated it, I reminded her. You called it a prison cell.
I was just being dramatic, she said with a shrug. It wasn't that bad.
Lucia brought me a frosted pint glass full of beer and then vanished as fast as she'd arrived. Maggie raised her white wine in a toast.
To new beginnings, she said.
We clinked glasses and drank, and I couldn't hold back my apologies any longer. I'm so glad you called me, Maggie. All those problems we had. I want you to know, I take the blame for everything. She cut me off with a wave of her hand.
Dad, I'm going to make this easy on you. Let's just wipe the slate clean, okay? We both made mistakes, but I don't want to spend all night relitigating what happened.
I'm trying to apologize.
And I accept your apology. We don't need to dwell on it. Everything's settled.
It didn't feel settled to me. I thought it would be good to discuss what happened and put everything on the table. But Maggie wanted to talk about the future.
I'd much rather just tell you about the wedding. Could we have that conversation instead? Would that be all right with you?
And of course it was all right with me. I was eager to hear all the details. Maggie said the gardeners insisted on paying for everything because they wanted to host the reception at their summer camp in New Hampshire, and the guest list was fast approaching 300 people. Aiden's mother had hired a wedding planner to orchestrate the logistics, but she'd left all the creative choices to Maggie. Invitations, place settings, table linens, centerpieces. There were 1,000 small decisions that required Maggie's attention, and she felt more overwhelmed than ever. Is there something I can do? She smiled like the offer was appreciated, but utterly impractical.
Not really. You just need to show up.
Then she must have glimpsed her fiancé through the windows of the apartment because she leaned closer to me and lowered her voice.
Here he comes. He's nervous about meeting you. So be nice, okay?
Of course I'll be nice.
And don't mention the bruises. He just got mugged, but he doesn't want to talk about it.
He just got mugged? There was no time for her to elaborate because the glass door opened and Aiden Gardner stepped outside to join us. My immediate thought was that he looked too young to be living in such a nice apartment. Aiden had the broad chest and shoulders of an adult, but his face still showed traces of a teenage boy. His hair was a messy brown mop that he probably combed with his fingers. His clothes were casual but looked expensive. A blue sports coat over a white V-neck, the sort of outfit favored by the boy band singers on my daughter's bedroom wall. And he was undoubtedly handsome, if you ignored the dark ring around his left eye.
Finally,
Maggie said, and she greeted her fiancé with a hug and a kiss.
We've been waiting forever.
Aiden and I shook hands. His grip was rock solid. If this kid was nervous, I certainly didn't feel it.
Mr. Zatowski, it's a pleasure to meet you, sir.
Call me Frank, please.
I'm sorry I'm late. There was an accident on the turnpike, and actually, you can still see it.
Aiden pointed out across the city to a ribbon of highway. We could see a short trail of red brake lights blinking on and off.
I just fought my way through that mess.
Don't worry about it, Aiden. I've been enjoying your view. It's amazing.
We can have dinner outside if you like.
Aiden turned to Maggie. Unless you think you'll be cold. Maggie loved this idea, so Aiden turned and rapped on the window glass, signaling for Lucia. She hurried outside.
Yes? We'll take our dinner here, Aiden said. Of course.
And I'll have an old Forester Manhattan with dry vermouth. He pointed to me. Frank, would you like another beer? In all the excitement, it seemed that I had already finished my first. Sure, but I can grab it myself if that's easier.
Lucia will bring it. Let's sit down.
We moved to a table for four at the edge of the balcony. As we all took our seats, I stole another look at his face. There was a cut I hadn't noticed earlier at the edge of his hairline, and Aiden noticed me noticing.
Sorry about this.
he said, gesturing to his bruises. I know I'm a mess. Maggie rested a sympathetic hand on his arm.
It's fine, hon. We don't have to talk about it.
I'm meeting your dad for the first time, and I look like I've come from a cage fight. We have to talk about it.
Only if you're comfortable, I told him. Maggie said there was some kind of mugging.
Aiden explained that a gallery in Chicago was exhibiting 5 of his paintings, and he stayed too late at the opening night reception. It was past midnight when he left for his hotel, and he'd found himself on a dark and desolate street. 3 men crossed the road to approach him. One of them had been carrying a gun. They demanded his wallet, and Aiden immediately turned it over, no questions asked. Then one of the guys decked him anyway, knocking him to the sidewalk, and the others started kicking him.
That's terrible, Aiden. I'm so sorry.
Lucia arrived with our drinks, and Aiden paused to take a long sip of his Manhattan. The alcohol seemed to steady his nerves. It could have been a lot worse, because while I was down on the pavement, trying to shield my head, I could hear a car coming. A taxi driver. He saw what was happening and started honking his horn, and the guys ran off.
Did the cops catch them?
He looked sheepish. I didn't call the police. I know I should have, but by that point it was really late, and I had an early flight. I just wanted to go home.
How do you fly home without your wallet?
Oh, I had my passport back at the hotel, and I used my phone for everything else. Thank God for Apple Pay.
Maggie took his hand and pulled it into her lap and turned to me.
And now you know the whole story. So let's talk about something else, okay? Something a little more cheerful?
I was happy to change the subject. I complimented Aiden's paintings and asked where he found his inspiration. He described his subjects as characters he spotted while walking around the city of Boston. School teachers, Uber drivers, bartenders, bouncers, nurses, and cashiers. He claimed to have an extraordinary memory for faces. He explained that a minute of careful observation was enough to lock a face in his mind, and then he'd spend days transferring the likeness to canvas.
They're incredible, Aiden.
He raised his glass in a salute.
Thank you.
I really mean it. They're so good they could be photographs.
He smiled through pursed lips while Maggie shifted uncomfortably.
Dad, that's actually not a compliment.
Sure it is.
It's actually one of Aiden's biggest pet peeves. He hates when people say his paintings look like photographs.
But they do.
No, they don't. You could never get these images with a camera. And think about your compliment from Aiden's point of view. Why did he waste all these hours painting if he could just snap an iPhone and get the same image?
It's fine, Aiden told her. I tried to correct my mistake. I just meant that they're very realistic, Aiden. I feel like you captured the souls of all these people.
I appreciate it, Frank, and no offense taken. I totally understand.
Aiden drained the last of his Manhattan and signaled to Lucia through the windows, calling for another. After his second drink, he seemed a bit more relaxed, though I was a bit surprised when he asked for a third. I couldn't tell if he was nervous or simply annoyed by the prospect of having to eat with me.
6. At 7 o'clock, Lucia started carrying out many small plates of food, serving the meal family style. There were so many courses, I couldn't keep track of them all. Maggie and Aiden were experimenting with a vegan diet, so there was no actual meat on the table, just mushrooms, eggplants, beets, roasted squash, carrots, and more, all prepared in ways I'd never tasted before. You wouldn't think that a big plate of vegetables could fill a person up, but after the 6th or 7th course, I was maxed out.
Lucia, you're a magician, I told her. If you cooked for me every night, I'd turn vegan in a heartbeat.
Thank you, Frank, she said, blushing again. Make sure you save room for dessert.
Throughout the meal, my daughter did most of the talking. She showed me her engagement ring, an enormous pear-cut diamond on an ornate gold band, and explained it was a family heirloom that had belonged to Aiden's grandmother. And she spoke with tremendous excitement about their wedding reception. It would be rustic and country style, with lots of wild flowers and outdoor activities. From time to time, I'd glance at Aiden to gauge his feelings, but he seemed happy to let his fiancée do all the talking. Clearly, Maggie was calling the shots, and he was simply along for the ride. I suppose a lot of young men feel the same way about their weddings, but I wanted to draw him into the conversation. "How about a honeymoon?" I asked. "Are you taking a trip anywhere?"
"Undecided," he said.
"Do you have any suggestions?" I told him that Colleen and I were always big fans of carnival cruises. As newlyweds, we took a 6-night excursion to the Bahamas, and the whole crew treated us like VIPs. I tried to describe all the incredible amenities, the water slides, the couples' massages, the Broadway-quality theater productions, but I must have prattled on too long because I realized Maggie had stopped listening. She was looking at a message on her Apple Watch. The stupid thing had been pinging and dinging all through dinner.
"I'm sorry," she said abruptly, standing up. "I need to call someone. There's a thing at work."
"It's 8:30, I said. "Who's still working at 8:30?
"Capacity never stops moving," Aiden said, and I realized he was quoting the company tagline from the Super Bowl commercial.
"Go ahead, Margaret. Don't worry about us. Your dad and I will hang out."
5 minutes, she promised,
and then she gave him a quick kiss on the forehead before darting into the apartment. Aiden finished the last of his Manhattan and then signaled to Lucia for another, his fourth, if I was counting correctly. "Is she like this all the time?" I asked.
"Only 7 days a week," he said,
with a good-natured shrug, like he'd already made his peace with her work habits. And then the conversation sputtered out. I tried a couple of polite prompts just to get Aiden talking. I asked about his family and his teaching at Mass Art, but his answers were short and perfunctory. He seemed happy to sit in silence and sip his cocktail. I remember feeling disappointed that he didn't ask me any questions. I'd hoped he might want to get to know me a little bit, or at least ask about Maggie's childhood. Instead, we just looked at the skyline in silence until Maggie returned to the balcony with a fresh glass of wine.
"Last interruption, I promise."
Aiden asked if everything was okay, and she just sank into her chair.
"Everything will be fine."
"Maybe you should tell your father the good news." There was a quick flash of panic in her eyes, and then she shook her head very deliberately.
"It's too early."
"But he's your dad."
"I know, but we already agreed not to say anything."
And by this point, I had a pretty good idea of what Maggie's good news might be. Anytime a man and woman hurry to the altar after 6 months of dating, there's usually just one reason. I crossed my finger over my heart and promised I wouldn't tell a soul, and then I leaned forward so Maggie could whisper her news. "What's the secret?"
She took a deep breath. "Well, Capacity's starting a new division for the aerospace sector, and I'm going to be on the team."
"Not just on the team," Aiden said. "It's a huge promotion. She'll have her own staff and everything." I must have looked bewildered because Maggie started explaining what it all meant. She said that the biggest obstacle to all electric air travel was the enormous mass of traditional lithium batteries. The true miracle of the miracle battery was not its incredible capacity, but its extremely low weight. The plan was to start with smaller planes for cargo flights before expanding to larger passenger airlines.
"And you're going to love this next part," she said. "We're already in discussions with UPS. Last month we met with Armando Castado, and he's totally on board."
Holy Mother of God. In a night full of surprises, this was the biggest bombshell of all.
Armando Castado started working at UPS in 1990 as a preloader and package car driver before rising through the ranks to become chief executive officer. I'd never known anyone who'd actually met him in person. Are you saying you spoke with Armando Castado? You were in the same room together?
Yes. And I told him you were a driver in the Circle of Honor. He was really impressed by that. He said he would remember your name.
She snapped her fingers.
You know what? We took a picture.
She reached for her phone and poked at the screen until she summoned the image and then showed it to me. And yes, there was my daughter with Armando Castado and a dozen grinning executives.
I can't believe this, Maggie.
Suddenly all the alcohol was hitting me, and I got kind of overwhelmed.
I don't even know what to say.
Say you're happy for me, she said. Because I am very, very happy, Dad, and I am so glad you're coming to our wedding.
She walked around to my side of the table and gave me a hug, and I couldn't help it. I might have leaked out a couple more tears. Aiden politely looked the other way while I dabbed my eyes, and then Lucia brought out coffee. And of course, it was the best coffee I'd ever tasted. And the night would have ended on a high note if I hadn't stopped to use the restroom on my way out the door. Lucia was in the powder room, so Maggie led me down a short hallway to the master bath, which could be accessed from either the hallway or the adjoining bedroom.
I'll box you up some leftovers, she offered. Meet me back in the kitchen.
The bathroom was ridiculously large, like something you'd see in a Real Housewives McMansion, with two sinks, an enormous shower stall, and a bathtub big enough for LeBron James. I used the toilet and then went over to the sinks to wash my hands. There were all kinds of beauty and cosmetic products spread across the counter. Aztec healing clay, charcoal-flavored toothpaste, bamboo fiber dental floss. I spent a minute or two browsing through everything, trying to decipher why someone might pay extra for Acqua di Parma Italian shave gel over good old-fashioned Barbasol. But I decided that much of Maggie's new life was going to feel strange and unfamiliar to me. Like her state-of-the-art electric toothbrush, charging on the edge of the sink via USB cable. I'd finished snooping around and was ready to leave when I noticed the toilet was still running. I waited another minute for the water to turn off, and I suppose I'd fixed enough toilets in my lifetime to know something was wrong. Either the flapper was rotted out and needed to be replaced, or maybe, hopefully, the float ball just needed to be lowered, because that was an easy fix. I pulled off the porcelain lid, set it aside, and realized the problem was actually the refill tube, that tiny rubber hose that feeds into the overflow valve. Something had knocked it loose, so I just clipped it back into place and saved the kids $100 house call from a plumber. Then I went to replace the lid, and that's when I noticed a black plastic bag attached to its bottom, held fast by many strips of duct tape. It was the same type of plastic bag you'd find in a kitchen trash can, trimmed and cut into a kind of small pouch. I poked it with my finger and felt something hard inside, with the same size and dimensions of my checkbook. Then came a knock at the door, loud and insistent.
Dad? Maggie asked. Is everything all right?
7. Sunday morning, I drove home to Pennsylvania and found Saturday's mail waiting on my porch. The highlight was a small cream-colored envelope with my name and address, handwritten in elegant black calligraphy. Inside was a card with the following message. Errol and Catherine Gardner joyfully invite you to the wedding of their son, Aiden Gardner, to Margaret Zatowski, daughter of Frank and Colleen Zatowski, Saturday, July 23rd at 3 p.m., Osprey Cove, One State Road, Hopps Ferry, New Hampshire. Reception to follow. I had scarcely finished reading the invitation when my cell phone beeped. It was my sister, Tammy, and she was singing in a warbly, off-key voice.
We're going to the chapel, and she's gonna get married. I can't believe it, Frankie. You must be so excited.
Did you get your invitation?
Yes, and Maggie just called me. She said you two have patched things up and you're finally speaking again.
Tammy wanted to hear all about my dinner in Boston, but I didn't know where to begin. I was still hung up on the black bag hidden in Aiden's toilet tank. I couldn't have looked inside the pouch without destroying it, so I'd just left everything alone, put the porcelain lid back on the toilet, and made a quick exit. But I spent most of the drive home obsessing over the bag and its contents. I figured it had to be money. I think it's good common sense to keep a supply of cash on hand so you'll be prepared in the event of an emergency. But why in the world would Aiden keep money in his toilet tank? It was so much easier to hide cash inside a book, or a canister of flour, or the pocket of an old, never-worn sports coat. A toilet tank didn't make any sense, unless he was trying to keep it hidden from Maggie. Because if you knew anything about my daughter, you knew she was never going to open a toilet tank and stick her fingers inside it.
So what's the verdict? Tammy asked. Do we like this guy?
Sure, Tam. He seems fine. She laughed.
Frankie, a frozen pizza from ShopRite seems fine. This is Maggie's future husband.
He calls her Margaret.
She likes the name Margaret. It sounds more professional. She works in a very male-dominated industry.
I had a hard time getting a read on him. He was polite, but very quiet. I'm not sure I met the real Aiden.
Or maybe you did. Maybe the real Aiden is polite, but very quiet. You could do a lot worse, Frankie. He's certainly better than Dr. Cellphone.
Dr. Cellphone, a.k.a. Oliver Dingham, was a sore subject for me and my sister, because we still couldn't agree on what that relationship had actually meant to Maggie. She was never going to marry Oliver Dingham.
Exactly. All the more reason to appreciate Aiden. I bet he was just nervous to meet you. Physically, you're a very intimidating figure, and the poor boy wants to marry your daughter. Put yourself in his shoes.
He wasn't afraid of me, Tammy. He was just disinterested. I tried to tell him about Maggie's mother, and he couldn't have cared less.
Or you're just misreading him, she said.
Tammy married at 19 and divorced at 21, and she's never had children of her own. But she spent the last decade hosting dozens of foster children. So she considers herself an expert on parent-child psychology. None of her placements have ever lasted more than a year or two, and she has certainly never parented a 25-year-old woman. But my sister feels qualified to give me unsolicited advice.
Frankie, let me tell you something. You've always been tough on Maggie's boyfriends, ever since she was a teenager, since she started dating. No one's ever been good enough for your little girl. But I don't see how we top this guy. He's handsome, he's smart, he's artistic, and he owns 80,000 shares of Capacity stock.
Maggie told you that?
I'd read it online. I've been Google stalking the whole family. Ask me anything you want about Errol Gardner.
She's marrying Aiden Gardner.
But the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, and Errol Gardner looks after his whole family. He's supporting all his sisters, plus 10 nieces and nephews, private high schools, fancy clothes, vacations in the Caribbean. These kids are like Kardashians.
You shouldn't spy on them.
They're all on TikTok.
I don't care what you call it. If you get caught, it's going to be really embarrassing.
Please, Frankie. I have so many aliases. I would never get caught. I'm just making sure our girl's protected. For example, do you know if she's signing a prenuptial agreement?
I had to admit, this question had certainly crossed my mind, but I never mustered the courage to bring it up. I don't know.
Well, I do know, because I asked her.
And?
I have a simple rule for living, little brother. If you don't ask, you don't get. So, when Maggie called me, I put all my cards on the table. I said, "Sweetie, I'm sure Aiden's a great guy, but your interests need to be protected. Are you signing any kind of prenuptial agreement?"
And? Tammy paused for dramatic effect. There was nothing my sister loved more than a big, fat, tantalizing shred of gossip. She could savor it for hours, pulling apart every detail and examining it from various angles, like a dog working all night on a turkey leg.
Do you want to guess?
I'm guessing there isn't, and that's why you're so excited. Tammy made a loud buzzing sound, like I'd just lost on a TV quiz show.
Wrong. They did sign a prenup, but it's the best possible kind of prenup. In the event of a divorce, regardless of the circumstances, they're splitting all their assets, 50-50.
That can't be true, Tammy. I didn't know what 80,000 shares of capacity stock were worth, but the value had to be astronomical. Why would he agree to that?
Because he's in love, completely smitten, head over heels.
She spoke like this was wonderful, fantastic news, but I didn't like it at all. I reminded her that they'd only been dating for 6 months. What's the big rush to get married?
Bite your tongue, Frankie. No father in the history of the world has ever asked that question. She's getting married at the perfect age to the perfect guy, and you don't even have to pay for the wedding. Do you know how many parents would kill to be in your situation?
A short while after our call, Tammy sent me a long email with research supporting her claims, links to all kinds of tech websites, newspaper articles, social media posts, and YouTube videos. I read enough about the Gardners to write their family history. Catherine Gardner, née Riggins, was born in Houston, the granddaughter of a prominent Texas oil man. She'd grown up in the white-gloved world of cotillions and debutante balls, then attended Wellesley College to study art history. There, she fell in love with Errol Gardner and New England, and she'd been a prominent Bostonian ever since, showering her inheritance on a variety of philanthropic causes. She sat on the boards of a dozen different charities and nonprofits, everything from Boston Children's Hospital to the New England Aquarium. Errol Gardner was born and raised in blue-collar Lowell, Massachusetts, according to his bio on the Capacity website, and spent 2 years at Harvard before dropping out in 1987 to start Apollo, one of the earliest internet service providers. All his early funding came from his young wife, and within 7 years, the company was bought by AOL for an undisclosed sum, rumored to be $100 million. Errol had been dabbling in new technologies ever since, everything from e-commerce sites to medical devices. Of course, Capacity was his biggest success, by far, and he was now CEO and the company's largest shareholder. It was impossible to read all this stuff without feeling intimidated. Clearly, Errol and Catherine were very smart and successful people, and I worried they would dismiss me as some kind of freeloader because I wasn't paying for any part of the reception. There was no way I could afford to host a party for 300 people, but I felt more and more convinced that I needed to do something just to arrive at the wedding with my pride intact. So the next day, I called Maggie and asked for Errol Gardner's phone number. She was instantly suspicious.
Why do you want his number?
I'd like to introduce myself, since you're marrying his son. Is that unreasonable?
No, but...
And I want to contribute to the wedding. I think I should pay for the alcohol. Tammy wasn't the only one doing internet research. I'd started looking at bridal websites, and they all warned that alcohol was the single largest expense of any wedding reception. I found an online calculator that let me input a number of guests, 300, and it gave me a predicted budget of $5,600 to $8,000, which was a real kick in the balls. But I hadn't taken a vacation in a long time, so I could easily afford it. I knew it would be worth $8,000 to attend my daughter's wedding with my head held high. Hey, everybody. The drinks are on Frank Zatowski, so let's give the guy a hand.
Dad, you can't pay for the alcohol.
I have to pay for something. Traditionally, the father of the bride pays for everything.
It's not the 1800s anymore. Errol Gardner won't take a dime from you.
Why not?
Because he knows your financial situation.
What's that mean?
Don't get sensitive. He just knows when I was growing up, we didn't have money.
I took you to Disney World.
Okay, sure.
We stayed on Disney property, Maggie. Do you have any idea what those character breakfasts cost?
Dad.
And I paid for your college. You don't have a dime of student debt.
Why would you tell him I didn't have money? Because money is relative, Dad. Compared to Errol Gardner, you don't have money. That's all I meant.
I do have money, and I want to spend some on this wedding. And now I would like this man's phone number, please.
Well, see, that's the other thing. You don't just call Errol Gardner on the phone. The man is booked 24/7. Even his assistants have assistants. And he's traveling this week. He's in Yokohama. He's meeting with Isuzu.
I sensed that if I didn't interrupt her, she would offer another 1,000 explanations for why contacting Errol Gardner was simply impossible. Maggie, I just want 10 minutes of the man's time, because his son is marrying my daughter. Now, if you don't give me his number, I'm going to call Capacity and explain the situation and ask for him myself. She sounded terrified by this alternative and promised to have Errol call me within 48 hours. The very next night, I was sitting in the dark in my living room, drinking a Coors Light and watching the Phillies lose to the Diamondbacks, when my telephone rang with a private number. Errol Gardner apologized for the late hour. He was calling from an airport in Osaka. Then he must have heard my television in the background because he asked if Zach Galen was pitching. I said that he was, but he wasn't doing his team any favors. Turns out Errol was a baseball fan, so right away we had something in common, and that made me feel more comfortable. He was very complimentary of Margaret. He described her as smart and confident and a real rising star at Capacity. I keep telling Aiden he hit the jackpot. The girl's a total catch. I'm sure there were boys knocking on your door all through high school. The worst ones didn't even knock, I told him. They'd just show up in their cars and text her to come outside. Errol laughed. Oh, I would have hated that, Frank. That must have been really hard for you. I figured I needed to return all of his compliments and say something nice about my future son-in-law. So I called Aiden a talented artist with a bright future. His father just laughed. He's picked a brutal way to make a living. I'll tell you that much. Name the 5 most important painters working in America. Hell, name just one. I confessed that I was the wrong person to ask, that I hadn't been to an art museum since middle school. But that's exactly my point, Frank. If you read the New York Times, you'll see hundreds of stories about artificial intelligence, gene therapy, nanotech, all these big world-changing innovations. Painting pictures is not one of them. I hate to say this, but nobody cares. It's a fruitless endeavor. But Aiden calls it his life's passion. So what can I do? I thought Errol was being unnecessarily tough on his son. I pointed out that it was brave of Aiden to blaze his own trail, to pursue a career outside his father's shadow. I'll tell you the hardest part of having kids, Frank. Eventually, they reach an age where you can't control them anymore. They're going to take drugs or rob banks or paint weird face portraits, and we can't do a goddamn thing about it. We either accept who they are or there's not going to be a relationship. Isn't that true? I wondered how much Maggie had told him about our 3-year estrangement. I couldn't tell if Errol was tactfully broaching the subject or if I was simply being paranoid. How's Mrs. Gardner feeling? Maggie mentioned some health problems. Most days she's fine, but once or twice a month she gets terrible migraines. Feels like she's been hit by a truck. All she can do is lie down in a dark room and wait for them to pass. But next week we're seeing a new specialist at Mount Sinai, and I think she's going to beat this thing before the big wedding. The entire call lasted just 15 minutes, but it was long enough to give me an impression of the man. Errol was smart, funny, plain-spoken, and unfailingly generous. When the conversation turned to the wedding, he encouraged me to invite as many guests as I wanted. He said that Osprey Cove, the name of their camp in New Hampshire, could accommodate about 100 visitors, and there were motels nearby for everyone else. This seemed like the perfect moment to introduce my proposal. I said it was very generous of him to host the wedding, but I insisted on contributing to the cost. I'd like to cover the bar tab. Oh, no, Frank. I couldn't let you. My family's full of alcoholics. My sisters will bankrupt you. I want to do it, Errol. Beer, wine, Long Island iced teas, anything your sisters want. It's too much money. I insist. Absolutely not. Please. Never. We went around and around like that for a couple of minutes, two middle-aged men with their pride and dignity on the line. Errol argued there was no way to fathom how much alcohol might be consumed, so I told him about the calculator I'd found online. I offered to send him the full $8,000 as a deposit and then settle up the difference after the wedding. Eventually, we compromised on $8,000, but not a penny more. And the next morning, I mailed a check to his office in Cambridge. It was a huge sum, my biggest purchase in years, and I felt a shiver of pride as I signed my name to the check. I knew it was money well spent. It felt like a sound investment in my daughter's future.